Sweden. Well, for those of you who are just joining us, polls have opened nationwide in Iran's 2021 presidential election, with nearly 60 million Iranians eligible to vote for one of the four candidates running. We're keeping a close eye on all of the developments right here on Press TV, and we'll be giving you on-the-hour updates from all the developments with regards to the elections. Also, someone else who's keeping a close eye on the latest developments is Omid, who's here to give us more details and also some background information about today's elections and also previous elections held in Iran. Omid, take it away.
It's the 13th presidential election, and you just heard a discussion on election at Press TV headquarters. Dear listeners, for your information, polls have opened nationwide in Iran's 2021 presidential election. Over 59.3 million Iranians are eligible to vote for one of four candidates running. Polls opened across the country at 7 a.m. local time on Friday, June 18th, and will run until 5 p.m. Of course, the voting is extended until 12 a.m. on Saturday and for two more hours then, if necessary. The leader of Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has cast his ballot early on, and also senior Iranian officials, including the heads of three branches of government, also cast their votes at polling states in the capital, Tehran. Officials have stressed that health protocols will be strictly observed in all polling stations amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Also, dear listeners, there are 67,000 polling stations across Iran and other countries for expatriates voters. Around 3.2 million Iranian expatriates are eligible to vote in 234 polling stations set up in various countries. Many people carrying Iran's flag is still queuing to vote at schools, mosques, and community centers. And also, along with Muslims, Muslim participants in the election, followers of different religious groups, religious minorities, including Christians, Jews, Zoroastrians, have also participated in this election. We have the information that the spokesperson of the Constitutional Council has recently said that no irregularities have been reported so far as Iran holds the 13th presidential election. And also, Iran simultaneously is holding a city and council midterm parliamentary and assembly of experts elections. Dear listeners, now we go back to the normal course of the IRIB English radio programs. And in the upcoming hours, we get you updated with the latest developments on Iran's 13th presidential election. Please stay tuned.
Uyghur people.
U.S. veterans' food insecurity.
Food insecurity is a dark reality facing many people across the United States, including a portion of war veterans, active duty members, and military families. They had been assigned to protect and serve their country, but many are now left with barely enough to eat.
George, I have something I'd like to bring to your attention, and I know you already know this, but I'm driving around the city every day, and I don't know what to do about it. I will think about it, but there's people on every corner with their cups and stuff, and it just breaks me up. You know, some of them are very, very, very distraught. You know, there's another veteran, a fellow brother of mine, he's in a wheelchair, one leg, right here on the service road. Mm-hmm. I always stop and give him $10. So, you know, 5-10 years ago, you'd see one or two of them, but now they're at every intersection.
Welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Mila Javamardi. And in this episode, we will delve into the critical issue of food insecurity among war veterans and military families in the United States. Stay with us.
But we begin today with the rather shameful and sad story of homeless and hungry veterans. Americans, they're not surprised to know that 500,000 people are homeless in America. We see them every day on our streets, many living there. But it's estimated that as many as 10% or even more are veterans, men and women who risk their lives serving their nation. And many more have some shelter, but they're hungry. How did this happen to the people who risk their lives to serve this country?
Since the pandemic hit, a recent study found almost 40% of active duty families have been in need of food support. Some surveys show that a significant portion of junior enlisted families have talked about food insecurity this year, which means even the newcomers are concerned about putting food on the table.
The United States led the ranking of countries with the highest military spending in 2020, with $778 billion dedicated to the military, but it still cannot handle food and shelter for a significant percentage of its service members. Our first guest in this episode is Dr. Rick Stagenberg, retired Veterans Affairs psychiatrist, who is now a social and political commentator and an activist for peace and universal healthcare in the United States. Welcome, Dr. Stagenberg. First of all, why are so many American war veterans food insecure?
That's a difficult question. Part of the reason is because a lot of them are traumatized by the war and they have difficulty caring for themselves. They can't be around people, they can't hold employment. And a lot of them are concerned about going to the Veterans Administration, which is the American healthcare system for veterans. And of course, if they're homeless, they're in the same boat as other homeless Americans, of which there are millions. It's random, practically, whether or not they can get services, depending on where they live. It's up to the local communities for the most part.
Many thanks for your insight.
Estimates of food insecurity vary widely, ranging from 6 to 24%. Comparing rates of food insecurity among households with veterans of the U.S. Armed Forces and non-veteran households sheds light on how the U.S. veterans are holding.
Last year, we kicked off a national food drive campaign to feed hungry veterans and military families. In 2011, we signed up to hire 1,000 veterans or military spouses, and we've hired almost 5,000 since that time. We're here to help.
Thank you so much for your service.
I was in the Battle of Okinawa when I was 18 years old. I was in special operations for 10 years. I did a combination of 26 years as an IT.
Veterans are cheered and saluted, but many are reportedly food insecure. According to the Department of Veteran Affairs, food insecurity among veterans is nearly twice that of the U.S. general population. We're now joined by Scott Bennett, former U.S. Army Psychological Warfare Officer from San Francisco. Welcome to the program, sir.
My pleasure.
What does food insecurity among veterans indicate about how the U.S. military is handled?
Well, it indicates the U.S. military is very, very needing of real leaders and real senior officers who are able to care for the men in traditional leadership parental roles. That has always been the role of an officer over his men, is to care for them in a sense of love and discipline. And it also shows us that the military lack of leadership is also matched with a lack of medical care and understanding of the soldiers and what they go through. Instead of prescribing rehabilitative community activities or counseling or things that can be very, very constructive.
Some very interesting points there. Many thanks for your insight.
There is also the problem of hunger among U.S.'s newest veterans, which demands close attention. Upon returning home, many of the veterans face unemployment as well as difficulties in reintegrating with their families and into the community.
What exactly happened to you?
I got relieved from the military due to Obama sequestration, so they reduced in forces, so they tackled the higher-ranking officers and NCOs to early retirement, but I was not able to retire at that time because I was shy, 2 years shy for full retirement. So they just took me off my orders and placed me on unemployability. And at that point,
you were like, "What do I do?"
Know what I do exactly, sir.
Kind of caught you off guard.
Pretty much, sir.
So where did you wind up?
Wind up not having a job, losing everything, and pretty much almost on the street.
Consistent ability to access sufficient food for a healthful lifestyle is a serious challenge facing the veterans and their families. The prevalence of food insecurity reported across the United States has prompted calls on authorities to take action.
Well, unfortunately, I'm afraid most of them don't realize that last point. They don't realize that they were really serving the interests of the rich, these corporate interests that basically control the government. They don't know why they went to war. They know it was horrible. A lot of them think it was a mistake because they didn't see anything good happening. But somehow they have to justify to themselves why they put themselves through all that. And so a lot of them, not all of them, don't really want to look at the fact that they were used and thrown away.
Food insecurity is the lack of access to a sufficient quantity of affordable and nutritious food. Relying on a single income makes it difficult for military families to get by, as the spouses of the military personnel cannot easily find jobs because they move around based on their spouse's services.
My name is Thomas Dickinson, and I'm a veteran of Iraq. I don't have to tell you that folks in the military are proud of what we've done. We're proud of our country. We're proud of our service. We're proud of ourselves. Unfortunately, that pride often masks the pain that we feel when we get back. Veterans have a higher unemployment rate and a higher rate of homelessness than many other groups in our population. And so as you show support for veterans on this upcoming Veterans Day, I ask you to do one small thing. Do one small thing. One small thing. Give a tiny bit of money, a tiny bit of your time to help veterans out.
Therefore, paying for personal necessities, including food, has become a challenge. Food insecurity also has been associated with increased healthcare costs, as families have to rely on calorie-dense and nutrient-poor junk foods, which are less expensive and more readily available.
As I said, the VA does a pretty good job for what they do. They would do a much better job if they were properly funded. But in terms of other aspects, let me just tell you that one veteran I worked with, and this was a World War II veteran, said that I didn't risk my life for this kind of country. He's old enough to see how the United States has deteriorated. This power has been transferred more and more from the people to these corporate fat cats in Wall Street, the ones who profit from the war. Fortunately, there are some veterans who do see this. a lot of them, I wish there were more of them, become Veterans for Peace, which is an international organization that I'm proud to be a member of.
Those who were supposed to provide security for the nation are themselves food insecure. Men and women of the military are facing a different battle, getting enough to eat. There are higher rates of food insecurity among certain groups of veterans, including Black and Latino.
They sent me to Chulai, and I ended up in 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, as a platoon commander for Kilo Company.
I'm a retired Army major. I went to Vietnam as an enlisted woman. I was 19.
If you're 26 years old and, you're enjoying life to the hilt, you know, and they're locked up for 8.5 years, I would say, yeah, it's a hell of a maturing process.
For many active duty military families, food assistance programs are a lifeline. For many Americans, the Federal Assistance Program, or SNAP, is a lifeline, but it is not an easy option for most military families. Many people and organizations joined forces to raise money to alleviate critical food insecurities. So, has the U.S. government done enough?
Well, I foresee the Biden policies only eroding and deteriorating both the military's effectiveness as a unit and also degrading and deteriorating the individual minds and souls and families and individual personalities of the soldiers. So you'll also have a lot more soldiers going on to welfare and homeless and in needing of government services, because the Biden policies have no interest in the emotional healing and well-being of the individual.
Some activists and lawmakers are hoping to change that. The Biden administration has been pushing for an increase in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP benefits, amid the growing numbers of food insecure Americans.
There was, back in the 1990s, a moment when it was clear that military families were beginning to apply for food stamps, what we now call SNAP. And there was a concern about the optics of this. So in their infinite wisdom, the military and Congress created a program that was designed to provide a supplemental subsistence allowance. And that was almost identical to the SNAP program, but only available to military.
Formerly known as the Food Stamp Program, SNAP is the largest federal food assistance program to provide low-income Americans with cash benefits to purchase food. It is also supposed to offer reductions in healthcare costs. Nearly 60% of eligible veterans are not enrolled in the program that supports fewer than 1.4 million veterans only.
They've been trying to privatize the VA. In other words, to have private providers, doctors and other healthcare providers, do the sort of things that the VA can do for itself. Now, sometimes we have to send people, or the VA has to send people to private providers because they don't offer that service in an area. That's perfectly reasonable. But the Veterans Administration is short about 50,000 employees right now, and that's unacceptable. One of the main reasons is the administrations are not paying enough money to doctors. The Health Administration, VHA, is not paying enough money to doctors and other health professionals to be competitive with these private providers.
Since the pandemic, the need for food has grown while cash donations have dried up since other people struggle. Food insecurity has skyrocketed through the pandemic for many Americans, but it has been an issue long before the novel coronavirus for many military families.
A lot of people came to the pantry, got what they needed, and then maybe they came back one more time, but then they were gone. COVID, we're seeing the same people week after week, month after month. Prior to the pandemic, in San Diego, for example, we were serving 400 families a month.
Active duty, military families, 400.
Post-pandemic, we had to shift to 400 a week.
Wow. So even before this unbelievable last year, there was a need.
a real need. What we hear from families is the issue is really childcare and spouse employment, and the two are absolutely inextricably intertwined.
COVID-19 has indeed worsened the situation in the low-income families generally. Having access to adequate nutrition needs to be a top priority for the whole nation, as well as the more vulnerable military families. So who is responsible for this situation?
Well, I'm not sure the military would be responsible for taking care of the veterans. That's not exactly it. It's the Veterans Administration that does. But as I said, that's one service that they're not mandated to take care of. So as far as the military, the main problem is that that our veterans are being exposed to conditions which predispose them to PTSD, and as I said, being unable to care for themselves properly. So in that sense, the military is certainly responsible, and of course even more so the political leaders.
Advocates have vowed to keep pressure on policymakers with a goal of reducing hunger in the communities amid the coronavirus pandemic. The normally hidden and underreported issue of food insecurity suddenly became very visible last year when lines at food shelves and meal pickup sites around the country became much longer.
Well, that was a total surprise. Lord have mercy. He said, I got this for you. He said, and it's $100 on that card, right? Oh, Jesus, I mean.
Not knowing where your next meal is going to come from is not a good feeling. And then the fact that a veteran, someone that served our country, has to go through something like that, along with a lot of other issues that he's overcoming and a lot of other barriers, it makes you want to do something.
Food insecure veterans tend to be younger, not married, and living in households with more children. Oftentimes, they earn lower incomes and have lower final military pay grade. Many of the food insecure veterans often use tobacco, more frequently binge drink, and sleep less.
So the veterans that discover this are very, very traumatized and emotionally frustrated, and that compounds the difficulty of day-to-day operations and life management. It often deteriorates their marriages, their relationships with their wives and children. That then advances them into chemical dependencies. You often have veterans being prescribed mental medications, hallucinatory medications, sleep medications to cope with some of these stresses. And those medications only amplify the stresses and make them much more difficult. So now you have a chemical dependency, broken relationships, a fractured identity, all because of the artificial wars.
Food insecurity among veterans often stems from mental health issues that they endure. U.S. veterans have had experiences that most Americans cannot even imagine, but they still have to worry about putting food on the dinner table.
So a lot of the causes are a livable wage coming out of the service, transferable skills that can get you that livable wage. Again, an understanding from the employers on how to deal with people who are coming directly out of combat zones and seeing some horrific things, and then being able to work in those environments. Again, you can't scream and yell at a person if they're late for work when they've seen those conditions.
Adapting back to civilian life when they return from overseas has proven troublesome for many, particularly for those returning from war zones such as Afghanistan, Iraq, or Vietnam. American soldiers coming back from war zones often experience depression and post-traumatic stress disorder, also known as PTSD, an anxiety disorder that follows experiencing a traumatic event.
Well, the reason so many veterans are food insecure are a combination of forces. Number one, the trauma of warfare when they come back has a very corrosive effect on their ability to manage their own lives. It has a very damaging, corrosive effect on their identity. Many of them come back with post-traumatic stress disorder, guilt. That is amplified when they begin to discover that the war in Iraq and Afghanistan were largely artificial, contrived, fake, and based on false evidence for political motives.
There are, meanwhile, Meanwhile, those who cite progress made in addressing veteran food insecurity in America made by the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. But many believe that the progress has been extremely slow when the severity of the problem is taken into account.
Greatest among these responsibilities is to ensure that our veteran and military families have a dignified quality of life that honors their sacrifices. But all too often, despite the efforts of our government, it falls to organizations like Feeding San Diego and Feeding America to close this significant gap between what our heroes have and what they need to provide for their families. I am proud of my organization, but I take no pride in the fact that our country stations people in San Diego without paying them enough to live in San Diego. And I take no pride in seeing ever larger numbers of veterans lining up at our Feeding Heroes food pantries every year. And the good news is that Feeding San Diego has innovative food rescue approaches.
With Congress and federal agencies failing to take due action to prioritize the critical issue, it could only get worse and increasingly more difficult to resolve. There are also reports showing that the available support for veterans is tinged with stigma and shame, sometimes even involving a complicated application process.
The medical military community prescribes medications, drugs, and other things to essentially numb the mind and make it less susceptible to nervous disorders. But ultimately, that is like filling a balloon with waste products, feces, and other poisonous substances that eventually the balloon explodes. And all of that matter and all that poison and toxicity and anger and frustration pours out and sometimes causes severe violence and suicide and other traumas. So it shows me that the military is really ill-prepared and unwilling to listen to legitimately help heal and rehabilitate the mental frustrations, the emotional frustrations, and the spiritual emptiness that many soldiers experience when they return from a combat theater.
Food insecurity is an important public health issue for U.S. veterans dealing with service-incurred health issues and socioeconomic challenges. The Pentagon is reportedly working to track the problem, in part by adding a question about food insecurity on a survey it will send to active duty spouses this summer.
I had been a high school teacher for a time. I couldn't take teaching with me when we moved up to Washington State because I wasn't certified to teach there. We also had no family in the area, so we didn't have any affordable childcare options.
The Navy income wasn't enough.
A lot of people don't realize is that when you are an enlisted service member, meaning sort of those lower ranking positions, it's often not really enough. It was really embarrassing. People constantly, when they find out that you served or that your partner served, they like to thank you for your service, and it really felt shameful. It was like I just didn't want anyone to know that that was our reality.
The issue of food insecurity is a complex one, making many in the United States wonder why so many men and women who have served the country should struggle with hunger. Yet the problem remains a prevalent one, cutting across gender, age, and even housing status. I'm your host, Mila Javamardi. Please tune in again next week when we come back with another episode of We the People.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The limelight.
Canadian politicians and segments of the media shoulder the blame for the endemic Islamophobia in the country. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you, written by Faisal Khati, journalist. This article is published under the heading Canada Truck Attack: Deadly Cost of Endemic Islamophobia. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. A man driving a pickup truck plowed into a Muslim family of five out for an evening stroll in the Canadian city of London, Ontario, in what police are calling a premeditated hate crime. A teenage girl and her grandmother, father, and mother are dead, while their nine-year-old son is in hospital. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau recently called it a terrorist attack, saying of the family members who died, their lives were taken in a brutal, cowardly, and brazen act of violence. This killing was no accident. This was a terrorist attack, motivated by hatred and the heart of one of our communities. Last year, a volunteer sitting outside a Toronto mosque had his throat slit by a man with alleged links to white supremacist groups. And 3 years before that, a terrorist entered a mosque in Quebec City and gunned down worshippers, killing six people and seriously injuring 19 others. How is this possible in a country touted for its multiculturalism and tolerance? This is no accident. Canadians have a lot to unlearn and relearn about Islam. Speaking at a 2017 ceremony marking the murders in Quebec City, Imam Hassan Gillet said, "We don't have enemies. I repeat, we don't have enemies. we have people who don't know us. After eulogizing the victims, the imam said that the terrorist killer was also a victim. Indeed, such killers do not just wake up one morning and decide to kill Muslims. Long before they execute their evil deeds against the innocent, hateful ideas, more dangerous than bullets or vehicles used as weapons, are planted in them. Much of the blame for their radicalization rests with certain politicians and segments of the media in Canada. Sadly, these killers are not alone in being fed negative ideas about Islam and Muslims. According to a submission to the United Nations last year by several organizations, including the National Civil Liberties Monitoring Group, 46% of Canadians have a negative view of Islam. Fewer than half would deem it acceptable for one of their children to marry a Muslim. 56% falsely believe that Islam suppresses women's rights, and more than half of Ontario residents feel that mainstream Muslim doctrines promote violence. In addition, the submission noted that 52% of Canadians feel that Muslims can only be trusted a little or not at all. 42% think discrimination against Muslims is mainly their fault. And demonization of Muslims has a long history in Western politics and popular culture, arising out of the Crusades, the legacy of colonization, and the post-Cold War hunt for a new enemy, but it has now reached a fever pitch. In the North American context, this bigotry is rooted in a culture of fear that has been nurtured for decades by many people in positions of power, but most aggressively since 9/11 as part of the so-called War on Terror. A discourse initially fueled by a well-funded network of professional merchants of hate laid the groundwork for a legacy of othering and dehumanization, which politicians have exploited it as needed. Certain Canadian politicians and segments of the media shoulder much of the blame for what Canadians have learned about Islam and Muslims over the last few decades. Words, actions, and silence all have consequences. The so-called War on Terror, fear-mongering that started with the Liberals, reached its peak under former Prime Minister Stephen Harper, when anti-niqab rhetoric curbing the inflow of refugees and calls to ban cultural practices were central election issues. Over the years, many more have bought into this moral panic, as evidenced by the hate-fueled debate over the introduction in 2016 by Liberal MP Graha Hollett of a non-binding motion to study Islamophobia and other forms of discrimination. Haters have always relied on conflation, misinformation, and obfuscation of acts. Some resort to dog whistle politics. Ultimately, the motion passed in March 2017, but despite the mass killings in Quebec that occurred just weeks prior, 91 MPs, including the majority of Conservatives, opposed the symbolic proclamation against Islamophobia. Conservative MP Karen Vico, who represents the riding where the Muslim family was killed in London recently, was among those who voted against it. No such objections were raised against a similar motion on anti-Semitism in 2015. Quebec has a long history of fueling Islamophobia. Over the past decade, the Parti Québécois has repeatedly created anxiety by proposing a charter of values aimed primarily at Muslims. Adding to the targeting of Muslim women, the Quebec Liberals introduced a ban on face veils in 2017. Not to be outdone, in 2019, the coalition Avenir Quebec tabled Bill 21, which bans certain public sector workers, including teachers, legal professionals, and police, from wearing religious symbols at work. Ontario helped to mainstream Islamophobia in 2005, when former Liberal Premier Dalton McGuinney banned faith-based arbitration. This went against the recommendations of former Attorney General Marion Boyd, whom the McGuinney government had appointed to study the issue. But why let facts get in the way when mob hysteria over the impending Sharia takeover of Ontario can be addressed by courageous politicians? The Western media, which focuses disproportionately on negative news about Islam and Muslims, also plays a role in disseminating false narratives. In 2018, within hours of a Toronto van attack by a non-Muslim man that killed 10 people, a CBC reporter tweeted, "Witness to truck ramming into pedestrians tells local Toronto TV station that the driver looked wide-eyed, angry, and Middle Eastern." She later deleted it, but the damage had already been done, as various journalists jumped at the chance to spread this news to their Islamophobic followers. When Islamophobia becomes a socially acceptable form of bigotry, as it has in some circles, we should not be surprised when it manifests in discrimination and even violence. It is well past time for government, law enforcement, and national security officials to take concrete steps to unlearn and reteach themselves and Canadians about Muslims.
Muhammad is my guide, Muhammad is my teacher, Muhammad my beloved Rasulullah.
I want to be like you.
Like you.
In everything I do, Ya Rasulullah.
I want to walk like you, talk like you, read my Quran just like you. Be like Muhammad, live like Muhammad, see like Muhammad did. Muhammad Rasulullah.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to the program Like Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wa sallam, where we are discussing, we are honored to discuss some of the great qualities of our beloved Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wa sallam. In one of the incidents where the behavior of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa sallam and the treatment of Rasulullah, you know, changed the scenario, changed the thinking of the captured ones, as it's about the battle of Khaybar you know, when the Battle of Khaybar happened, when the Army of Islam became victorious, after the battle, as usual, the Army of Islam, they captured so many ladies and so many people from the tribe of the Khaybar people, the Jews. So one of the captured one was the Safiya, the daughter of Hay bin Akhtab. And Hay bin Akhtab was a scholar of Jewish people. You know, he was a Jew scholar, and he was a very famous scholar. So Bilal Habshi, the companion of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, was taking one of the captured and with the daughter of Hay bin Akhtab, Safiya. And Bilal made them cross, you know, pass from the, you know, dead bodies of the people of, you know, the Khaybar, who were killed during the battle. And the Safiya's brothers and relatives were among them. So when Safiya saw that her brothers and her relatives are beheaded and their dead bodies are in front of her, then she started crying and she scratched her face. When Bilal brought Safiya and others in front of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa sallam, then Rasulullah asked, "Why did you do this? What happened to you?" Then Safiya said that, "I saw my brother's dead body. That's why I could not control my emotions." Then Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wa sallam became very upset from the hands of Bilal. You know, in the history, it is said that the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam said, "Unzi'at minka ar-rahma ya Bilal." You know, this is, you know, something very strange. Bilal is a great personality, and nobody has any doubt in his sincerity and in his iman. But because of his act, the Holy Prophet said, "Unzi'at minkar rahma." Allah does not shower his blessings upon you, ya Bilal. حَيْثُ تَمُرُّ بِإِمْرَأَتَيْنِ عَلَىٰ قَتْلَىٰ رِجَالِهِمَا. Because you have passed and you have taken these two ladies from where their relatives, their beloved ones killed, and they saw them. You know, this act of Bilal made the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam very upset. The Holy Prophet, now look, this is very important. You know, he is facing two ladies, and one of the ladies is very hurted because of this incident. So Holy Prophet here, he compensates the sorrow of Safiya. You know, what did he do? Obviously, when Safiya saw that Holy Prophet was angry from Bilal, and the Holy Prophet said, "Why did you do this?" Because of this, she accepted Islam. And Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam honored her with marrying her. You know, a lot lot of ladies, they had this, wish, this was their biggest wish to marry Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. And here the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam honored Safiya with marrying her. And after marrying her, he freed her. But again, look at the character of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Safiya here refuses to go away from the Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. She emphasized that I do not want to leave Ya Rasulullah because I have fallen in love with you because of your actions, because of your mistreatment, because of this honor and respect you have provided with me. So Allah, Allah, look at the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam's behavior with these, kind of normal people.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi.
So that's why your Safiya becomes, Safiya falls in love with the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and she stays and she remains a wife for the Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. By this act, the small guilt the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam felt in the heart of Safiya, it was removed and Safiya was totally happy. So look at the, Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Even he wants to remove those small, guilts and small bad thinkings the normal people have about the behavior of Rasulullah and the companions. So this also again teaches us a beautiful lesson in our lives. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
جئت بعد العسر يسرا ربنا أعلاك قدرا يا إمام الأنبياء أنت في الوجدان حي أنت للعينين ضي أنت عند الحاضري أنت هاد وصفي يا حبيبي يا محمد يا نبي سلام عليك يا رسول سلام عليك يا حبيب سلام عليك صلوات الله عليك يا نبي سلام عليك يا رسول سلام عليك يا حبيب سلام عليك صلوات الله عليك.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 41 meters, 7410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. We'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.